mind reader.
Mind reader? Were you thinking about me again?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk, we do mind reading all the time. Why not also mind sharing?
Sounds like science fiction if you ask me. Do you think I'm telepathic?
No, you can use gestures, facial expressions, body language.
Why not just use your words?
It's not just the mind reading or the telekinesis, it's something else.
The way we tend to move seems to be well designed to kind of make it easy for the other person to know that the reason we're moving our bodies is to communicate and not to do something in the world.
Do you exaggerate your gestures when other people are around?
These spontaneous gestures seem to be helpful for production and for comprehension.
Our guest is Yale psychologist Julian Jara Ettinger.
It helps other people understand you.
Mind sharing.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
How do you know what someone else is thinking?
Can you really put yourself in another person's shoes?
Or are we always doomed to get it wrong?
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Lanning.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the Stanford Humanities Center.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
We're very grateful to the Stanford Symbolic Systems Program for sponsoring this episode.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk.
Today, we're thinking about mind sharing.
You know, Ray, I love this topic so much. Human beings are constantly sharing their minds with each other. I mean, I'm doing it right now just by talking to you.
Yeah, and it's not just talking either. You know, I can tell just by looking at your face that you're excited to be here tonight and that you're kind of confused.
How'd you know that? You're right. I'm actually a little confused. Like, here's what I'm confused by. We seem to be able to pick up on other people's beliefs, desires and intentions, and we can do it, just like you said, even when they're not saying anything, right? We look at their movements, their gestures, their facial expressions, and just from that, like from the twitch of an eyelid, we know exactly what they're thinking. How do we do that?
Well, I think we don't. You know, we're wrong all the time. You might think that, for instance, your friend is mad at you, but actually, they're just really tired.
Well, yeah, it's true. I read a study recently saying that we're all vastly overestimating how much time other people are spending thinking about us, which I don't know whether to think of as demoralizing or encouraging.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you get it wrong all the time, and sometimes you're just puzzled. Like, why do people go on reality TV shows like Who Wants to Marry a Millionaire? What are they thinking?
I don't know, Ray. I mean, is that really so complicated? Maybe they want to find love. Maybe they need a little attention. Maybe they're looking for a little pocket money.
That was three possibilities, and you don't know which one is the right one. If you just get reduced to spinning out option after option after option, you've got no idea what's actually going on.
That's only because I don't know them. But look, if a bunch of my friends went on reality TV, God forbid, I feel like I'd have a pretty decent idea of their reasons. Like, each of them might have a different motivation for going on that show. But whatever it is, I'm 99% confident I could figure it out.
Yeah, really? Even without them telling you?
Yeah. I mean, I know my friends. I know what they care about. I know what gets them out of bed in the morning.
But you don't. You know what they say. You know what they do. But you've never been inside their heads. So how can you possibly know what they're thinking?
By putting myself in their shoes. Like, so, you know, whenever one of my friends does something, I imagine what it would feel like if I were doing it, and that clues me into what they must be thinking.
No. That's you imagining what you would feel like, not what they would feel like. And people are different. Just because you would feel a certain way, why does that mean your friends would feel the same?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like I can use what I know about human nature. I mean, each one of us has some kind of main goal in life, right? And we're very likely to be spending a lot of our time and energy pursuing that goal. So if one of my friends is constantly hustling for money and playing the stock market and all that kind of stuff, and then that person goes on Big Brother, I feel like I can be very confident it's all about the Benjamins.
Well, that was some excellent theorizing from a literature professor who's got big ideas about human nature. But what are the rest of us schmoes supposed to do when we want to know what other people are thinking?
That sounds like a you problem, Ray. But seriously, I think our guest today is going to help us figure all of this out. It's Yale psychologist Julian Hara-Ettinger. He's an expert on social cognition.
But first, are twins better than the rest of us at knowing what's going on inside another's mind? We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to find out. She files this report.
The year is 1976. In the small farming town of Twinsburg, Ohio, about halfway between Akron and Cleveland, the twins are gathering for the first ever Twins Day.
My sister and I were both in the parade.
Andy Miller, who has a twin sister, is now the executive director of Twinsburg's annual Twin Festival. When the country's bicentennial was approaching, the town's residents were thinking of new ways to celebrate. Twinsburg was founded in 1818 by identical twins, Moses and Aaron Wilcox, who died just hours apart.
Since the founding fathers of Twinsburg were twins, they decided, well, let's celebrate that way. It was one day up at the town square. They had originally 36 sets of twins in attendance. You know, they had a bike parade. You could decorate your bike from bicentennial.
And the tradition continued year after year. In the 80s, Andy and his sister were even the grand marshals.
I think going through the list of local twins, I think we were kind of next on the list.
Andy says at the heart of Twins Day is pride. Twins can feel like oddballs. They are rare, about 3.3% of all live births. And a lot of popular culture paints an otherworldly image of twins.
This is the only place where they can go where they feel normal. They don't necessarily feel gawked at. They actually are proud.
Writers and filmmakers have long been fascinated by twins, like in Edgar Allan Poe's The Fall of the House of Usher. Roderick and Madeline are biological twins, and when one twin gets sick, so does the other.
Thy soul shall find itself alone, mid dark thoughts of the gray tombstone. Not one, but all the crowd, to pry into thine hour of secrecy.
There's this really dark, pathological image where twins get presented as being like unwell, often violent, you know, sometimes murderous psychopaths.
Helena DeBresse, a twin herself, is the author of How to Be Multiple, The Philosophy of Twins.
I don't think that twins are the same person, but I think they can kind of act as a single person, or they can kind of function as a single self in certain ways.
Either twins are monsters or represent the perfect human relationship, mirror images of each other.
Then you and I are like sisters. Sisters. Hallie, we're like twins.
But on the other hand, twins shouldn't be too close or for too long into adulthood. Society wants us to be self-sufficient and have good control of our boundaries. Twins mess up that whole idea.
Twins put pressure on a very narrow understanding of what it means to be a person, particularly in Western culture.
And that's a good thing. Soon, thousands of twins will once again gather at Twinsburg, Ohio, to join in on the parade, head to the beer tent, and reflect on what it means to be multiples.
Why, what peculiar little figures. Tweedledee and Tweedledum.
If you think we're waxworks, you ought to pay, you know. Contrary to us, if you think we're alive, you ought to speak to us.
Twins Day is just another chance for people to celebrate one of the many ways of being different and, similar-wise, being human.
That's logic.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that great report, Holly. I just find those twin studies infinitely fascinating. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And we're with a live audience at the Stanford Humanities Center for a program generously sponsored by the Symbolic Systems Program.
Our guest today is a professor of psychology at Yale University, where he runs the Computational Social Cognition Lab. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, Julian Hara-Ettinger.
So Julian, I know you've been thinking for quite a while now about how we know what other people are thinking, but when did it first strike you as an interesting puzzle?
It's my parents' fault. They love reminding me of my childhood social blunders. So one they love talking about is when I was about 5 years old, growing up in a semi-rural part of Mexico. I was out playing, and I found this piglet on a twine leash tied to a pole. So I untied it, and I brought it home, and proudly declared that I had found a feral pig that was now my pet. And my parents were, of course, concerned, trying to explain that that was not a feral pig, and it was not mine, and I had to give it back. And I was just baffled by how they couldn't understand, like, what had happened and how I had now my new pet.
And they were so ungrateful to you.
I wasn't allowed to keep the pig.
Aww.
So, Julian, I think this illustrates the point that Josh and I were arguing about, you know, about whether people actually know what each other are thinking. So Josh seems to think that they do, and I'm pretty skeptical. So who's right?
I think you're both right in different ways. So, of course, we get people wrong all the time. I think that's one of the most memorable things about being human. You're just kind of sitting there wondering what was going on in that person's mind or what happened or when they say something that sounds off to you. But if you consider how many times you interact with another person in a day, there's just so many, and we're so good at quickly figuring out what's going on in other people's minds to the extent that it's important for what we're trying to do, that we just forget about it and we move on through our lives.
So what makes the difference? Why do we so often get it right, but then sometimes get it wrong?
I think it partially depends on the kinds of things that are really important to get right. So if you think about like these common problems that we face all the time, like you're walking down the street and you need to avoid people that are walking in the other direction, or you're talking to someone and you're trying to figure out if they're paying attention to you or if they got distracted, or if it's someone that you really care about and you're really just trying to put in the effort to see what's going on in their minds. I think those are the kinds of situations where we need to be really good at it. And we fail in the cases where it often doesn't matter that much.
So effort definitely makes sense that it would be part of it, but I can exert a lot of effort and still not be good at something. Why are we good at this really hard task?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think in some sense it's because we can't afford not to be good at these basic things, right? We live this incredibly social life where we spend the most of our times just interacting with other people, whether it's in person or online, and that's in some sense the key thing that allows us to do all of these amazing things, like having language and being sitting here talking about how whether we're good or bad at being able to understand other people's minds.
And so, you know, because we're constantly doing it all the time, right? So we're observing people's behavior and facial expressions, and on the basis of that, we're attributing beliefs and desires and intentions to them, and that allows us to predict their future behavior and to make moral judgments and to coordinate. What do you think it's mostly for, either from an evolutionary standpoint or just why we should be grateful that we can do it? Is it mostly about this things like this, where we're collaborating together and trying to you know, produce a goal together?
Yeah, it's always hard to know why a certain cognitive capacity evolved, because unlike the evolution of bodies, which leave a fossil record, the mind doesn't. So we don't actually know why we got good at this. But I think a reasonable guess is that whenever you have creatures that want to live in a social group, it's just important to be able to understand a little bit the other agent's behavior and predict what they might do. And if you start developing those capacities, it seems like a very good way of doing it is being able to kind of represent the other agent that you're seeing or the other creature as having a mental life that's kind of like giving rise to everything that they do. And once you have that, then you can use it for all sorts of things, like persuasion and moral judgments and so on.
This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Stanford Humanities Center. And we're thinking about mind sharing with Julian Jara-Ettinger from Yale University.
Do you have a favorite gesture you use with your friends and family? What does it mean? How else do you communicate non-verbally?
If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. Along with questions from our live audience. When Philosophy Talk continues.
If I don't speak, can I still show you that it hurts? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Yale psychologist Julian Hara Ettinger, and we're thinking about mind sharing. Special thanks to Stanford's Symbolic Systems Program for sponsoring today's episode.
Do you have a question or comment for our guest? Share what's on your mind. Join the conversation by raising your hand, and Laura will bring the mic to you when it's your turn.
So, Julian, we've talked a little bit about how we can know each other's minds through sort of mind reading. You also think about something called mind sharing. What is that? How is it different from mind reading?
Yeah, I think in this question of how it is that we're able to understand each other so well, historically people have called this mind reading as kind of like trying to highlight that we're just amazing that we can just see someone's body movements and from that start to build a really good picture of what they're experiencing and what they know and what they want. But there's growing evidence that maybe that picture is incomplete. It's really a joint activity. Often the reason people can understand us is because we are motivated for people to understand what we're doing. So we know how to behave in certain ways to kind of like ease the problem of other people for them to know what's going on in our minds.
So what's a good example of that?
One of the best examples are these very kind of classical studies showing that if you have people do some of the most basic tasks, like reaching for an object, whenever someone else is watching, people tend to exaggerate their movements more than they would when they're alone. And they exaggerate in the right directions to kind of like help the other person realize what you're going for. Interestingly, that also happens when parents are in the presence of a baby. There's also evidence that in those cases, people tend to exaggerate their movements, kind of like trying to make it a little bit easier for the baby to understand what you're doing.
So how much of that is on purpose and conscious, and how much of it is just automatic, and how do you tell?
Yeah, I think it's a mixture of both. In these cases, these kinds of like variations that we do in our movement, I don't think we notice. I definitely don't. But there's, of course, many cases where we're very aware of what we're doing. Often, I mean, the most common form of mind sharing is this very explicit thing that we do, which is talking, right? Right now, we are explicitly with a clear goal trying to share what's going on in our minds.
So we can be explicit, we can exaggerate our movements, we can indicate things with facial expressions. What about gestures? I mean, gestures seem like a thing that we do. Maybe I'm doing it right now. Radio listeners can't hear, but I'm using my hands a lot. Sometimes unconsciously, but sometimes consciously, right? We can, you know, especially if you're from Italy. Italians have a fantastic range of gestures to communicate, you know, it's time to go, or you're boring me, or you can't be serious. So what are those about? What are gestures about? Why don't people just say what they want to say instead of gesturing?
Yeah, that's actually something that we've done a little bit of research on. There's good reason that you might want to use gestures on top of what you're saying. We know that that actually helps with understanding. So when someone is trying to understand what you're saying, the addition of gestures helps. But there's many cases where it's just useful. Like if someone is far away and you want to wave at them, or if it's too loud, or as you're saying something, you want to multitask and highlight that you've noticed someone and you're greeting them. And in those cases, what we've come to find is that the way we tend to move seems to also be well-designed to kind of make it easy for the other person to know that the reason we're moving our bodies is to communicate and not to try to do something in the world. So a very simple example is if you think of the thumbs up. When you give a thumbs up, you're kind of putting your hand in a weird position that makes it very difficult for you to like grab objects or do anything else. So if someone is watching you, when you take that body position, it's just kind of clear that you're not trying to act on the world. Another example of that is a gesture that's very common in Mexico. It's going to be tricky. I'm going to try to describe it. You basically take your palm, and you raise it, and then you flip it. So your palm is facing inwards. And that's a polite way of saying thank you. And again, it involves putting your body in a weird position that makes it very difficult to act on the world. So that's a very useful way to help people immediately know that what you're doing is a gesture.
Are there any gestures that do double duty as useful actions? Or is it always about doing something inefficient so that the person doesn't know you're trying to do something useful? Or sorry, knows that you're not trying to do something useful, but you're trying to communicate with them?
Yeah, so there's an interesting distinction there where sometimes there's gestures that we use to communicate abstract concepts. So when I wave and I'm saying hi, that's not something physical in the world. So things like yes, no, hi, thank you, those are in some sense easy because all you need to do is make sure that the person knows you're not trying to do something in the world and they need to know what this gesture means. Then there's this whole other category of gestures that we produce, which is when we're trying to kind of pantomime something or teach something. And in those cases, there's less research on that, but it seems like it's this interesting balance where, on the one hand, you're trying to make sure it looks recognizable to what you're doing, but adding the right kinds of exaggerations to get people know that you're not actually just doing the behavior itself.
So one gesture I often do is to say, well, on the one hand, you might have this idea, and I put the idea somewhere in space in front of me, and on the other hand, you might have that idea, and you can look at the first idea, where I put it in space, or you can look at the second idea. Does that count as functional or arbitrary? How do I even think about that?
I think we currently don't know. The problem with a lot of these kind of improvised gestures is that there's reason to believe that they're also helpful for our own thinking. So the ability to kind of like move our bodies as we're talking is just kind of like helpful in it. And it's this problem where these gestures, these spontaneous gestures, seem to both be helpful for production and for comprehension. And it's possible that that's just a side effect. Maybe we just like to move our bodies because it's helpful as we're thinking and we're kind of like trying to think with our bodies in some ways. And then it just happens to be coincidentally helpful that it helps other people understand you. So it's difficult scientifically to distinguish between those two forces.
Let's talk a little bit about language, because it seems like there are equivalents of these things in language, right? I think about interjections like oops. So if you knock something over and you're on your own, you might or might not say oops. Mm-hmm. But if you're watching me, you know, I want to let you know, presumably, I did not intentionally smash your mug in front of you. So do some aspects of language function this way as well? In other words, as a way to share our minds by introducing a bit more inefficiency? Like, I didn't need to say ouch. I expend a little bit of energy, and it's just for you. Are there some uses of language like that?
Yeah, I think that's a phenomenon that's been slightly understudied relative to the broad range of things that have been studied in language, but that does seem to be the case. So in the case of interjections, it is true that it's very convenient that we have all of these very brief sounds that help align what's happening in our mind so that other people can understand. So things like oops or oh or hum or like all of those you can think of as like very quick forms of mind sharing to help the other person keep good track of what's happening in your mind. But also what we found is that people will often, when they're talking, they will add inefficiencies that they think will help the other person figure out what you're talking about faster than you would otherwise. So, for instance, if we are in a room like this one that has a lot of objects, even if there's just one mug here, if I called it the mug, I might put a lot of work on the listener to find what I'm talking about. But if I say something like the white mug on the coffee table, that's technically being a little bit inefficient. I didn't need to say all of that because there's just one mug, but it's being very helpful at getting you to know what I'm talking about.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about mind sharing with Yale psychologist Julian Hara Ettinger, along with a live audience here at the Stanford Humanities Center. And we've got a question from that audience.
Yes, Larry from Oakland. What about interspecies mind reading? My dog is looking up at a shelf, wants the stuffed toy to tear it to pieces, and looking at me, looking at the toy, looking at me again. I know what's going on in his mind. He knows what's going on in my mind. So.
I love that question. So in the case of dogs, that's kind of a relatively new topic in cognitive science that they sometimes call dognition. And most people that have owned pets have this experience of feeling that, of course, they understand us. What we don't know yet is if dogs and other pets are really good at actually learning how to communicate with us and try to mind share in some ways, or if it's us that we are just so good at thinking about things as if they have kind of like very complex mental states that are kind of like trying to do these really interesting things and we just kind of like overread what's happening. But I again, having pets myself, I think once you have one, you just become convinced that they truly understand you and they communicate in all sorts of ways.
So let's take another question from the audience.
Yes, my name is David. I'm from Menlo Park. And my question has to do with gestures. In your research, have you found that there are universal gestures or groups of gestures that have been exhibited by all humans, and over what periods of time, going back to our ancestral gestures?
Yeah, that's something that we've been curious about. In terms of universality of gestures, it's a little bit of a tricky time to study it, because now that you have the internet, they appear everywhere. In fact, when we were collecting this gesture database to figure out what common signatures they have, you can have a gesture and you ask people, where is it from? And people from 10 different countries will all tell you that it's from their country. So it's a little bit hard to tell. What we do know is we've tried to do a little bit of work tracing back and figuring out like what are the oldest gestures we can find. And so we have some records. There are records available from gestures in ancient Rome and Greece. And we know that those also seem to have the same kind of signatures of consisting of body positions that make it kind of like very obvious that you're not trying to act on the world. What we've also done is we've also put people in experiments where they're forced to suddenly just come up with a new gesture to see what they do. And what we find is in those cases, people will spontaneously also try to do something that very quickly reveals that you're not acting on the world. So that gives us reason to believe that it's not a very slow process of cultural evolution. It seems that individual people are able to immediately consider that someone needs to understand what you're doing and try to like produce the right body movements that will make that clear.
But that raises the question, if these movements are designed to be essentially arbitrary, they can't be movements that are trying to achieve something in the world, then different cultures are going to evolve different kinds of gestures. And that seems like it would be a block to mind reading across cultures. How is someone from Italy going to share their mind with someone from the United States, for example, if we have such different systems of gestures?
So I think there's two different questions there. One of them is different cultures have different sets of things that they try to accomplish, and that shapes their behavior. I think in that case, it's actually more important than the time. So compare right now to, say, 50 years ago, we have very different kinds of objects and technologies that we interact with. So we don't know this yet, but I suspect that that might end up shaping the kinds of gestures that we produce, because now you can imagine with things like the Apple Vision Pro VRs, there's a lot of movements that now suddenly people are going to be producing in the air. And that means that now there's this whole space of body movements that used to be good for producing gestures that is going to become unavailable. So we're going to need to move them and use them in different ways.
So this actually reminds me of just the experience of walking down the street and hearing somebody talking and thinking they're talking to me and discovering that they're talking on their phone. So if we can figure out how to navigate that, I'm sure we can figure out how to navigate gestures of people using VR headsets. But we've got another question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Henry from Houston, Texas. I'm actually a twin of 19 years, and I have still not been invited to Twinsburg, but maybe next year. So my question was, do you think that the young children who, you know, maybe ages 4, 5, 6, who spent almost 2 years of school on Zoom have a less developed ability to kind of do this mind reading, you know, because they didn't get to really learn it, you know, in the flesh?
Yeah, I think that's one of the new frontiers in cognitive science. The pandemic has created a whole generation, basically all of us, missed some kind of period of our lives at different stages. And I think we don't know yet how that has impacted us. What we do know is that the basic building blocks that we have to be able to understand other people's body movements, including their gestures, seem to be at work surprisingly early. Basically, kind of like as early as we can do experiments with infants, they seem to already have some understanding of these notions that agents generally move efficiently and that like deviations and efficiency are meaningful in some way. So it's very possible that this lack of experiences might cause some differences, but I think it's unlikely that it would cause a kind of like significant problem that's irreversible.
Brings me to a related question about virtual communication, right? We spend a lot of our lives on Zoom, and some of us are still spending quite a lot of our lives on Zoom. When we don't have our full embodiment to draw on, do we do more with our voice? Do we do more with our facial expressions, maybe with our hands or something like that? Do we compensate in some way?
That's a great question. I I don't know of any research on this, but we do know that we do that not in this new generation of a lot of Zoom, but when email started, we found ways to start modifying how we talk to kind of like convey additional sentiments that are not just captured by plain text.
So are you thinking about emoticons and emojis?
That's right, and exclamation signs and uppercase sentences.
And it all worked so well.
I mean, we're confused about each other anyway, but we've got another question from our audience.
Hi, I'm Kaumudi from Palo Alto, and I have a question regarding group dynamics and gestures. Have you ever done any studies or come across, you know, the situation where a group of strangers is placed together and not allowed to verbally communicate, and studied how they organize themselves into a coherent group that can function?
I haven't done any research on that, but that reminds me, this is not exactly a question about gesture itself, but we know that there's been these kind of like natural, you can call them natural experiments, where if you put children that can't speak, so they have to gesture, they can very quickly come up with a full-blown language of comparable complexity to any of these languages that have existed for a long time. So this is the case of the Nicaraguan Sign Language, where they took a lot of children that were deaf in Nicaragua, and when they were put together in school, within a few years, suddenly there was a full-blown language. So,
yeah, so I think this kind of raises a puzzle for me about how these arbitrary symbols sort of get going. So if you're making an arbitrary sign, then maybe I know that you're not reaching for something. You're trying to communicate something. How do I figure out what it is that you're trying to communicate?
Yeah, I think that's where you can think of it. There's these reinforcing powers, right? So on the one hand, even if you don't recognize a particular, the meaning of a gesture, we're really good at knowing when something is a gesture. If people have the opportunity to travel abroad, sometimes notice that you might see some kind of body movements, and even if you don't know what it means, you can get the sense of saying like, oh, what I just saw is some kind of gesture. In that case, once you know that, you can kind of use your mind reading abilities and figure out, well, what are the possible things that someone might want to communicate here? How are people responding to that? Or you can just ask them. And then once you have that, then you've basically added one more gesture to your repertoire.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about mind sharing with Julian Hara Ettinger from Yale University.
Do you ever wonder what your loved ones are thinking? Could science help you improve your communication? How can we get better at understanding one another?
We're coming to you from the Stanford Humanities Center for a program generously sponsored by the Symbolic Systems Program. We'll take more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues. Can you read my mind? If not, I'll help you. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Julian Hara Ettinger from Yale University, and we're at the Stanford Humanities Center thinking about mind sharing for a program generously sponsored by Stanford Symbolic Systems.
So Julian, these are such interesting psychological questions and insights. I'm wondering if people can use what you and others have discovered to communicate better with their friends and family.
Yeah, I think the main lesson in a lot of this research is that, well, first of all, we're remarkably good at a lot of mind reading and understanding people very quickly. But for that reason, sometimes we can overestimate how much people understand what's going on in our minds. And what we're finding is that it's not just about mind reading, it's about mind sharing. So often when we have the experience that someone gets us wrong in some way, we can feel some frustration and feel like maybe this person didn't care that much about me or they weren't paying attention. And another way of thinking about it is saying like, well, we have to also mind share, and it's okay if sometimes someone doesn't get us right and we need to help them.
So we have a kind of almost a moral obligation both to understand other people and to help other people understand us.
Help other people understand us. Yeah.
So one thing that I often run into and struggle with is trying to figure out whether I've correctly mind-shared. So once I've tried to share what I'm thinking, there's this extra step of, did the other person get me? Are there ways to get better at that, or do you have advice about that?
Yeah, there's some research on this in language, and I think the basic lesson there is sometimes we don't have to worry too much. As we're talking, sometimes we can accept that we're not going to say exactly the perfect thing and it might not be right, and the other person is going to help us. This is often called repair. So as you're speaking, if you say something confusing, the other person can just ask for clarification and then you can just move on from there. So you don't have to feel like the whole burden on saying everything perfectly clearly is on you. You can just give it a shot, and if it doesn't work, they'll let you know.
And how does neurodiversity play into all of this?
I think historically, particularly in the case of autism, there was this really big idea that autism was in some sense a deficit of mind reading. That was a very popular idea that received a lot of attention, but it seems to not necessarily be the best theory that explains the full both spectrum of neurodiversity and the autism spectrum disorders, and also the whole range of things. So I think what's clear is that some neurodiverse people, and it's common in autism, sometimes have trouble mind reading or understand situation, and those are also particular cases where just being helpful is the best thing to do.
I think I have a question about how to identify why somebody has failed at mind reading, even if it's myself who I'm trying to identify their error. So mind reading seems like a kind of complicated skill that requires you to do a lot of other little things that aren't mind reading. So for instance, if I want to know what Josh is thinking by looking at his face, I have to be able to see his face properly. And maybe I have to not be in pain or distracted by other stimuli. So is there a specific ability of mind reading that you can isolate? Or when I have failures, like, should I sometimes be looking for other places?
In other words, is it my fault? That's what you're saying.
Exactly. Of course it is.
Yeah, what we know so far is that it's a mixture of both. So there's certain processes that seem to be automatic and inevitable. So they seem to be happening within perception, that we can quickly detect things like attention and other people's intentions. And then there's the heavier, the harder layer, which is you can quickly tell that someone might be looking at something or might have paused to think. And then you have the challenge of, well, what are they thinking about or what's happening? And that's where you really need to bring the whole context to bear. And I think those are the cases where if you don't have a good sense of what's actually happening, that's the experience of feeling like there's something going on in the other person's mind and I have no idea what it is.
It's so interesting. I mean, this whole question about success and failure and also about variation is really interesting, right? It seems like some people are probably just better at this than other people. Some people are very good at mind reading. Doesn't necessarily make them good people, right? Presumably con men are very good at mind reading. And presumably some people are very good at mind sharing. I wonder if actors might be particularly good at mind sharing. I wonder if poets, you know, to ride my hobby horse. You know, could it be the case that at least some painters, movie makers, poets, and so on, they're kind of blessed, either a gift that they were just given, or they've somehow worked their way to being really great at mind sharing, at getting across subtle and complicated emotions?
Yeah, I think that's the case. There's probably all cognitive processes, there's variability across people. What I would suspect, though, is that it's not just that some people are objectively better in every possible way. It's rather mind reading involves a lot of different situations and a lot of context, and we develop certain expertise. That's I think also what happens when we develop expertise with certain people. When we know someone very well, we know very quickly how to mind read and mind share in ways that we can't do when we meet a stranger or someone from a different culture.
We have another question from our live audience.
Hi, I'm Ray from San Mateo. I grew up in the deaf culture, and expression and facial expressions and gestures are obviously important in American Sign Language, ASL. And given that also children in bilingual, meaning oral hearing households, will sign before they speak, and given that gesture is so fundamental to that language, is there any evidence that the deaf are more accurate mind readers or more effective mind sharers than oral speakers?
That's a really interesting question. I don't know of any research that has tested that. And I think it would go back to this. My best guess, if I had to speculate, is that probably, yes, in some ways they are better mind readers because they're facing different kind of social demands in their everyday lives. And I think, again, like everyone, we ultimately live a certain kind of life that requires certain kinds of social interactions, and that kind of practice just makes us good. So actually, yeah, one study that we've done is we have tried to isolate how good we are at inferring different kinds of mental states. And what we find is that people are in general very good at inferring some mental states, like what other people like. If you see someone pick a few things, it almost feels obvious what they like. Inferring what other people know gets a little bit harder. But then if you move to inferring how other people see the world in these hypothetical cases where people might see the world different than you do, people struggle a lot. But if you just keep giving them a little bit of practice and have them do it over and over, within the span of 10 minutes, they start getting a lot better. So there's reason to believe that there are these differences, but we can very quickly adapt to the kinds of inferences that we need to make.
So we've got another question from our audience. What's your name and where you're from and your question or comment?
Hi, my name's Catherine, and I'm originally from the UK. And my question is, where do overthinking and second-guessing fit into all of this? Because I find that a lot of the time I get things correct when I like interact with someone and I do know what they're thinking, and then later on I'll second-guess myself and think, oh, were they really annoyed at me, and sort of change things in retrospect. So where does second-guessing fit in?
Yeah, I think, I mean, there's second-guessing is something that we all experience, and not only in social situations, but you can happen all over the place. I think in the case of mind reading, it's the challenge is that there's so many different things that someone could be thinking that there's always space to think more about it. So it's like an infinite spool of possibilities. So I think that's a case where the more you think about it, you can always keep coming up with new and new possibilities of what might be happening in someone else's mind. And that basically makes it kind of an impossible task. Like you can just, every time you think more, you realize there's more to think about. And I think that's part of what makes it difficult when we really try to get someone right and we try to kind of like exhaustively explore the possibilities.
Okay, but we've been operating as though it's always, you know, the more you know, the better. The more access, the better, the more sharing, the better. But are there contexts where we want a little bit of privacy in our minds, or, you know, we're all wandering through our days being a little bit inauthentic just to get through our day, right? And sometimes we're competing rather than being collaborative. Aren't there times when people are trying not to mind share? I mean, how does that work if we're unconsciously prompted to share?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is something that there's not too much that's known about yet, but intuitively, it does feel like there's many cases where we don't want to mind share, and we know how to do it. We can just decide to just look down and not
poker
move
face.
Our bodies and, yeah, exactly, have poker face. And of course, there's also many cases where we don't care to know that much about other people's minds. Like if you're walking in a busy train station and you're just trying to get to your train, every single person that's walking by, you don't need to know exactly what they know about the train station, what they're trying to accomplish. You just need to know roughly where they're going and forget about the rest of that's going on in their minds.
Next question from our audience.
Larry from Oakland again. driving down here, it was pouring, and I really had to pay attention to driving. So what about mind sharing when you can't even see another person? They're in a car, and you have to pay attention to what's going around you. It's a very intricate ballet almost. You know, you have to pay attention and, you know, is this person going to cut me off? Miscommunication, road rage. So how does all of this apply to those times where you can't even see someone and you're in a, you know, vehicle speeding along way over the speed limit and it's pouring out and you need to pick up the cues from everybody around you?
Yeah, that's a great example that really shows how much we rely on the rich body movements and sounds that people make, because when you reduce them to a car that's moving around, we have the experience of just wondering what is going on in that person's mind. And in fact, what we have to do is add these kind of additional technologies to Mindshare, right? If you think of blinkers, those are essentially a way of kind of like broadcasting our intentions to other drivers.
Julian, this conversation is giving a whole new meaning to thank you for sharing. We appreciate you joining us tonight so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our guest has been Julian Jara-Ettinger, professor of psychology at Yale University, where he runs the Computational Social Cognition Lab.
We'll put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and mind read our library of nearly 600 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we may feature your question on our blog.
Now, a man so fast he's already read your mind, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, it seems that the power to read minds is something we all fear. One of those fears we picked up from mythology and B-movies, like fear of quicksand or bottomless pits, or someone entering from a secret passage to drop a tarantula on your pillow as you sleep in the bedroom of the enormous house you might inherit from the sinister uncle you haven't seen since you were a child. If someone can read your mind, they might know that you're secretly the avatar of an Egyptian princess, for example, which draws the attention of the mummy in the local museum who comes lurching to your house to drag you off to be his immortal bride. Who needs that? The ability to read minds is sometimes an idle fantasy, like flying, invisibility, getting three wishes from a genie, or going back in time to rehab that conversation that got you kicked out of the house. Reading minds means you can see if a person is really into you or is lying about being in the CIA, or where he goes when he goes away for 2 weeks every other month or so. There goes the through line of every other true crime story. Discovery Channel reenactors would be out of work. Lie detector sales would plummet. All the psychics at the carnival would pick up their tarot decks and make their sad way home. Also, reading minds means your thoughts are open. You can be blackmailed or embarrassed. One of the offshoots of mind reading, and another great fear in the wake of the Cold War, is brainwashing, where your thoughts are no longer your own, and you wind up assassinating your mother at a political convention. Who needs that? Or hypnotism, where you can be induced to do things like clucking like a chicken at a party about which you will have no memory, but which, if repressed, can later be accessed through hypnotism. Ironic. There's a big subset of pornography devoted to hypnotism and mind control, and a hefty chunk of mysteries whose solution turns around either a victim hypnotized to walk into a buzzsaw or a killer hypnotized to pull a trigger. Sherlock Holmes could read minds or at least trace intentions just by looking at stuff people had lying around, like scuffed shoes or a snake coming down from the ceiling or the footprints of a giant hound. Hypnotism has been a major factor in the Truth About Flying Saucers department, not to mention the Satanic Pedophiles department. The early 20th century was full of sinister hypnotists like Svengali and Dr. Mabuse, not to mention the rampant abuse of truth serum. Nowadays, we don't even need hypnotism. We conned ourselves into thinking that Taylor Swift rigged the Super Bowl, that there was a dungeon underneath a DC pizza parlor, that Putin was just a regular guy. Some beliefs live in that gray area where dwell Santa Claus, professional wrestling, and Bitcoin. Not quite fairy tale, not quite real, or only real as long as you believe it, like seeing a ghost or a UFO or the Blessed Virgin Mary. In a famous experiment, people were led to believe that they had had their picture taken with Bugs Bunny at Disneyland when they were a kid. They remembered it vividly, even though Bugs is not a Disney character. If he showed up at Disneyland, Goofy would tear him to ribbons with his soft gums. So the mindscape of America can be horrifying and comforting at the same time. Recently, science has suggested that consciousness is a quantum wave that connects to the entire universe. So that's reassuring. It makes mind reading seem like it can be a snap once we suss the algorithms around that and how to surf snaggy synapses using only our brain. Of course, they could be surfing your brain as you're surfing theirs, which could be migraine-inducing or just chaotic. I mean, what are those thoughts? If you're thinking of a dog, for instance, well, which dog? The dog you had when you were a kid? How would I know that? Is it Lassie? Old Yeller? Goofy? Is Goofy even a dog? Many thoughts have been wasted on that one. I've had them all. Then there's the Jedi mind trick. These are not the droids we're looking for. But they were the droids you were looking for, weren't they? But then you wouldn't have had the movie franchise, I guess, just a bunch of unemployed stormtroopers playing three-card Monty in the welfare line. That's what I'm thinking. But you probably already knew that. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2024.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. Senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dan Brandon is the technical director.
Special thanks to Merle Kessler, Rebecca Barron, Karen Ajluni, Linda Fagan, and Pedro Jimenez.
Thanks also to Michael Frank, Todd Davies, and the Stanford Symbolic Systems Program, which has generously sponsored today's episode.
And thanks to Patricia Terrasis and the staff here at the Stanford Humanities Center.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, from subscribers to our online community of thinkers, and from the members of KALW San Francisco Bay Area, where our program originates.
The views expressed
or misexpressed
on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber, question everything in our library of nearly 600 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thanks for listening.
And thanks for thinking.